Welcome back to UW Medicine Town Hall. I'm Trish Critic, Vice Dean for Faculty Affairs, and it's my pleasure to have with us today Ann Browning, our Assistant Dean for Wellbeing, Carrie Nazenbeni, CNO at UWMC Northwest, Santiago Neme, Medical Director at UWMC Northwest, John Lynch, Head of Infection Prevention and Employee Health at Harborview, Tim Dellett, our Chief Medical Officer for UW Medicine, Rick Goss, Medical Director for Harborview, and Jason Dell, CNO at Harborview. Couple folks are away on vacation, which is great for them. And we've got a good group here and lots of questions to get through. So with little further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Ann for her well-being message. Ann.
Thanks, Trish. So we've gone to monthly, which means we haven't been together in a little while, and a lot has happened. One of the hats I wear, I'm a senior fellow for equity and brain health with the Atlantic Institute, which is housed at Rhodes House in Oxford, and for the first time in the pandemic, we finally had a global convening last week, which is very exciting. So I flew out to London, acclimated for about 48 hours, started the convening, and on the third morning of the convening, during our kind of pre-meeting testing every day, I ended up coming up with a positive test. So I ended up shimmying off to isolation in a hotel room in Oxford. I started zooming into 10 to 12 hours of meetings per day from like three blocks away, which was mind-numbing and hard. And overall, I was incredibly lucky. Like for me, having COVID was kind of having a fairly mild cold with kind of an annoying sore throat. So in that sense, I was really, really, really lucky. But that first night I spent in isolation, I barely slept. So I had kind of two goals in my mind around COVID over the last couple of years. And it was one, don't get COVID, which I managed to go about 26 months without getting. And two, if I got COVID, do whatever I could to make sure I didn't pass it on to anyone else. And I didn't sleep that night because I was so mortified that I was going to wake up and all of my other colleagues from this convening, more and more people would test positive and I would have been their point of contact. And the next morning, nobody else tested positive. The morning after that, nobody else tested positive. And for the duration of that convening, no one else tested positive. I am so grateful that I think I've managed to get through this. And to my knowledge, I have not passed this on to anyone else. But that was not a very easy experience to go through. And it was just really, really tough. It was tough for everybody else to be so worried that, you know, they might have had it, might have contracted it. So I'm lucky. I managed to come home without too much delay. I managed to move through this pretty quick. And, you know, overall, my takeaway, man, this BA2 is tough. Like, I was in the UK. I still mask indoors everywhere. And you know what? Somehow I got it. Vaccinated, boosted, somehow I still got it. So a takeaway I have is, like, man, it is not worth letting down your guard too much. Like, we can do really minimal things to still kind of protect ourselves and each other. And I'm so glad that folks in the convening I was at, people were still masking indoors and taking precautions, and it meant I didn't get anyone else sick. So to the extent that we can, still be kind of vigilant and that this is still present and still moving about. And we might not be able to keep ourselves from getting sick, but the best we can do is still try and take care of ourselves if it happens and each other by trying to make sure we don't pass it on. So a bit of a heavy experience and a well-being message, but I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Trish.
And thank you. I'm going to thank you for two things. One is for sharing what's hard and super personal, and I think it's the first of us at Town Hall who've had COVID, and for you being willing to talk about it with people. So thank you for doing that. And then secondly, thank you for not getting really sick, because while you were losing sleep about getting other people sick, I was worrying about you back here. So I'm so glad you're back and that you're doing okay. And maybe you have some Uber immunity now. So I'm happy about that too. So I'm glad you're back and okay. And thank you again for sharing. I really appreciate it. So with that story in mind, John, I'm going to start with you and kind of have you tell us where we stand across UW Medicine and King County, because we had some questions about like what's happening in the county.
Yeah, sure thing, Trish. So as of this morning, UW Medicine facilities are up to 15 patients, in our hospitals with COVID-19. Four of those folks in the ICU, 11 are in the acute care units. Valley is at 3, Northwest at 3. UWMC Montlake is at 5, and Harborview is at 4. And I think Harborview is leading the way with ICU patients. We have 3 there. Importantly, Seattle Children's Hospital, thanks for giving me those data. They continue to have about 5 patients pretty much every day for the last number of weeks. Fortunately, all are in acute care, no one in the ICU, but it's pretty steady throughout for at least a few months now. When we think about the county, so I'll just say those numbers in our hospitals are maybe creeping up ever so slowly. And I think that's really a reflection of what's going on in the county. Public Health Sauk County, just looking at the dashboard yesterday, or actually this morning report out, it's actually increased about 36% in the last 7 days. We've had about 2,700 cases in the last 7 days compared to about 1,900 cases in the week before that. And just to give you a context, I think when we last talked, we were probably around 1,200 cases. So we've gone up about 100%, right? We've basically doubled the number of cases in King County over the last just couple of weeks. After a long period of hospitalizations going down and down and down, it sort of leveled out in the middle of the week. And as of this morning, hospitalizations have actually increased. Now, it's going to sound like a big number, 52%, but the percentage. But what it really is about 32 hospitalizations in the last 7 days versus 21 hospitalizations. So still low numbers, but a kind of a big shift relatively. And again, fortunately, deaths continue to trend down quite steeply, 63%. So about 17 people have passed away in the last 2 weeks versus 46 people in the 2 weeks before that. And when we think about those numbers, those transmission rates, when we last talked, we were getting right around down to around 50 cases per 100,000, which would have put us almost in what's called the moderate category. Remember those tiers that we talked about? So we're right around 50, 52. And we are now back up to, I think it's 119 per 100K, which puts King County back up into the high transmission range right now. So the last thing I say, because I do think it's important, and this probably is going to be part of your next question, UW Clinical Virology and DOH are tracking the BA2 variant, the sort of type of Omicron, and it's now the vast majority of all cases going on out there. So pretty much everyone who's getting infected now is getting infected with the BA2 variant. The data only goes up to the end of March, but at that time it was about 80% of all cases. And that's, so you put a couple more weeks on that and how steep it was changing. It's pretty much all cases now.
Okay. So I think take homes that I heard were numbers are still low, but as opposed to kind of coming down, we're seeing things going up a little bit, both in terms of cases and hospitalizations. And that we think it is predominantly BA2 that people are getting infected with. I think that was one of the questions people asked about is like, do we think this is all BA2? I think the other thing people asked is, do we think this is a reflection of not having a mask mandate anymore? So kind of where do you think that plays into this?
Yeah, so I'll make one little course correction in your comments. So I would say transmission rates are actually pretty high. We're seeing a lot of cases out there. So when we're at 110, 120 per 100,000, that's actually a lot of transmission. And I'll just say it's a really big underestimate. Gross underestimate, because we're doing a lot of people are getting tested only because they have symptoms or there's some really serious exposure. A lot of people doing home antigen tests, right? And those asymptomatic people are not getting tested. So there's probably a lot more COVID transmission going on out there than we think. So that's one thing to take home. Yeah. Lots out there. And I think Ann's story is I'm here actually every day. I have friends, colleagues, family members who are telling me the exact same thing. Lots more people getting infected, particularly this week. So that's one part. As far as what's driving this, it's some fraction of the fact that are engaged without masks in more public activities, that we're gathering together in more public activities. And the other fraction is this BA2, which is somewhere between 30 and 50% more transmissible than BA1, which was way more transmissible than Delta. And so we have a very transmissible variant in a situation where we are close together much more often and we're not wearing masks in the way that we did before.
Yeah, so it's a combination of those things, a much more transmissible virus, and we're not doing the stuff that we were doing earlier as we have kind of pulled back from those things. Mm-hmm. One thing that came up as a multiple question is, are we seeing people getting BA2 after they had the earlier Omicron variant. So a second infection, both with Omicron.
Yeah. So it's a little hard to know that for sure. It's more of a research question because we don't know the sequence a person has based when they get sick. So we find that information out. And the reason why some of that sequencing data that I told you about is only up through the end of March, because it takes time to do that. And it's more for public health awareness at the population level than how we think about each single person. That being said, you know, the outside of BA2 looks pretty much a lot like BA1, the outside. There are a lot of differences, particularly on the inside, and some minor differences on the outside. But the outside, the part that our immune system sees, is pretty similar to BA1. That's why it has that shared lineage, and it's called BA1 versus BA2. So the infection mediated immunity, if you had gotten infected with BA1, the first Omicron January, works against BA2. And the vaccines work pretty similarly as well.
Okay. So seems like the protection that we might have from having an infection or being vaccinated would apply to BA2, but we don't know for sure. And it's hard to know on the individual basis if that's, you know, people are getting infected and then infected again, what exactly those were. So I think the take home is there's a lot of it and it's more transmissible and we're not wearing masks as much as we have been for sure in the past. Okay. I'm going to come back to this probably later, but I have to talk about the single most common question that we received in the last few weeks. And that is, since we last came together, there was a recommendation from the CDC for certain populations to get another booster. And so really the most common question was like, should I get a booster? And I'm another booster. And so maybe you could reflect a little bit on that. And I'm going to invite like Santiago and Tim, if you want to weigh in on this as well. It feels like a little grayer than earlier times when we had this question.
Yeah, I actually really look forward to hearing other people's opinions on this, anyone on this panel, to be honest, or in the Q&A. So I would say that the way it's set up right now is that second booster shot for folks who are over 50 years of age is being posed as an option. It is not a requirement. It's not even a strong recommendation. It's a may. And that word may is really important when you think about public health language. So it's an optional booster. Now, why did that happen? I think it's a combination of things. We do have some data from groups, particularly in Israel, who have really been at the forefront of looking at vaccine effectiveness, mostly in health worker populations, but in other populations. And there's some small studies. There's one or two larger studies that may have a signal. I wouldn't say absolutely convincing, but a signal of reduced hospitalizations, particularly in older adults, for folks mostly over 65, potentially people who have other medical problems, particularly heart problems, lung problems, and things like diabetes. But I wouldn't say it's like super compelling. And it's really in those special, you know, small age groups. And typically we would look at multiple studies from around the world looking at those same age groups. I'd say that the way the FDA looked at this is they had sort of this signal. And these Israeli researchers, many of them have been right in the past, you know, in retrospect, when we look at subsequent surges like Omicron. But what we do know is that if you look at measures of immunity, things like antibodies, neutralizing antibodies particularly, they do tend to go down over time. And what we know is that it's been a little while since a lot of people got that first booster. And the flip side is in those studies, we know that giving people a second booster is very, very safe. So when you look at, well, we have these antibody data that are going down, some evidence of waning immunity, not maybe clinical, right? Not looking at how many people get sick, how many people in the hospital, but really look at just those numbers. And you look at how safe it is to give one. That was, I think, really drove the FDA's recommendation to do this. And then the director of the CDC signed off on it. Though it did not go through the Advisory Council on Immunization Practice. Sorry for my dog.
That's okay.
He has opinions about the booster as well.
Evidently, so, she feels strongly.
Feels very strongly. And I think that's in part. So we don't really have like that ACIP sort of recommendation guidance on the second booster.
Okay.
So I'm going to just put one little plug in here is that we're kind of in this middle period where I think we have really awesome data on your base vaccinations, right? Two mRNAs or single J&J and a booster. Those data are really profoundly good. And we're still way behind on that at the US population. And of the people who are even eligible for the first booster, only about 60% of people are boosted. So we have actually a lot more to go on getting people fully vaccinated and up to date. But for folks, I would say my perspective, I'm in that age group, this is eligible for the second booster. And I'm kind of like, I'm lucky. Like Ann said, I'm pretty lucky. I'm healthy. I live with people who are healthy or are vaccinated. I'm sort of taking it slow, one step at a time here, thinking about what's coming up next. And I'm not necessarily rushing into that second booster. The part here that's in the middle is we may be looking at regular boosters, you know, like think about influenza vaccination. We may be looking at variant specific, sort of like we already do with influenza vaccination, where it changes every year. And I'm going to sort of just wait and see how things are going, because I got that privilege of being fairly healthy and living with healthy people who, you know, who don't have, you know, compromised state, who aren't much older and similar. So that's my quick perspective, or maybe not so quick.
Not so quick, but good, because I think we want them. If this is a nuanced space, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I'm going to highlight what I heard, and then I'm going to invite Tim into the conversation. What I heard was we're kind of didn't do the same exact process with that committee that reviews it, but we did it based on data about antibodies waning. We don't have the same data about risk of getting hospitalized or dying from COVID for this second booster. But the feeling was there may be benefit, particularly for older folks or people with other medical problems, heart and lung disease. And I heard you say, I'm slowly walking towards getting this booster instead of running towards getting this booster, and have held off so far. How about you, Tim? What are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I thought John summarized it really well. The other piece that I wonder as they were looking at this is they were seeing pretty striking increases across Europe at the time as well. And so I think some were thinking, well, do we want to try to mitigate potential additional increase here? We are seeing some increase here. Hopefully it won't be as significant as what we've seen before. And I wonder if that played a role. When I made my own personal decision, because I'm also just into that eligibility, and also I think would recognize that the data is pretty, not quite there as strong. What tipped me is a little bit is I also will be going to London for meetings here at the end of April, and watching what's happening over there, decided, you know what, weighing the risk benefits, and I have a lot of confidence in the safety of these vaccines, that I went ahead and did that and got the second booster this week, largely anticipating that I was going to be doing additional travel. And just kind of watching what's happening in different parts of where I may be going. But I think it's an individual choice given, that data. And I also fully anticipate that we'll likely see some sort of a recommendation again next fall, right? Whether you get boosted now versus likely, I think many of us anticipate that we'll see some sort of an increase again next fall, if not before then.
So that's really helpful. Thank you for telling us what you did. I appreciate that. I'm going to ask two follow-ups. People ask, like, I'm also thinking about traveling overseas. Is there a right time to get the booster if you're going to get it?
Yeah, I mean, typically when you get vaccinated, you need a couple of weeks before you think that you're going to have adequate response. And so for me, I'm going to be leaving April 30th. So this timing made sense for me. Just given those anticipated plans.
One more follow-up. Did you mix and match, or did you stay with the same?
I stayed with the same, largely just because I knew I tolerated the version of mRNA vaccine that I had gotten before, and so I just stayed with that. Again, I think there's, I'm not as convinced about that data either in terms of, is there real value of going from one mRNA to another? Very much from a J&J to an mRNA, absolutely.
Yes.
But I think, again, from one to another, again, I looked more in terms of what I knew that I tolerated well.
Okay.
I'll just point out there have been good studies on the mix and match. It's very safe. And from a theoretical perspective, it's a pretty reasonable option. So if people do choose to do it, totally reasonable. If people choose not to, also a very reasonable option. But
so safe. I'm going to say it again. Safe with mix and match and well-tolerated. So reasonable to do it, but also reasonable not to. And then I think, Tim, I heard you say you want to have 2 weeks before you travel. One last question, and then Santiago, I'm going to pivot to you, but maybe John, I'll ask you this. There were some data about that just came out that says, well, that boost you get from this booster doesn't last as long. So You want to comment on those data, and then I'm going to pivot to Santiago.
Yeah, and again, I'm not a laboratory immunologist, so there's people on this call who are probably much more well versed in this topic than I am. So I'll plead a little bit of grace here. Is that yes? I think this is one of the challenges when we're starting to really make a lot of decisions based on laboratory data without very clear clinical correlation. I worry we sort of get into this and we're sort of chasing our tail around looking at neutralizing antibodies or other antibody measures as sort of the temperature of whether a vaccine is works well or whether a booster is needed.
Mm-hmm.
We have to recognize there's a lot of other parts of our immune systems that are amazing and critical for our vaccine mediated immune responses to infection, T cells and other things. And I think that's a part that remains fairly unmeasured when we make these discussions and make these decisions. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that I'm cautious about these interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that where I am taking some of the information and thinking about how it's going to impact our practice is that point I made is I would not be at all surprised. And I'm probably closer to if I had to make a prediction, us moving towards some sort of annual vaccination campaign than I have in the past based on some of those data. It makes sense immunologically, and I think it makes sense from just a process perspective.
Okay. We've said this before. Antibodies aren't the whole story to your immune system and your immune response, and it's looking more like we're going to have some kind of annual vaccine, and I'll probably come back to that later because I think people are wondering about the fall, so I'm going to table the fall for now. Santiago, I wanted to ask you a question about, John was saying we don't have the same amount of data that we had before about boosters. So are we doing more to study the impact of another booster or what booster or when to do the booster?
Yeah, thank you, Trish. I actually talked to Dr. Anna Wald earlier today, and she told me about three studies where they're looking at healthy volunteers who have been vaccinated with one of the approved vaccines. And they're looking to study the effect of the booster. And the key studies are three. I'm going to put this in the chat so that people can see, and also the phone number to be brief because there's a lot of description. But for healthy volunteers, if you want to sign up for these studies and help the research, that would be awesome.
Okay, so more studying going on. All right. One last question about boosters. I'm going to turn to you, Tim, for that. And then maybe I'll come back. We have a bunch of other questions, but this was by far the most common thing people asked about. And I think I already know the answer, but I'm going to ask it because it was asked multiple times. Are we thinking about requiring a second booster for UW Medicine at this point in time?
Not at this time, no.
Okay. So this is, again, I think fits with the, we're trying to figure out where this fits in and it's just somewhat individualized. I appreciate that. I lied. The other thing that people asked about was, what are we going to do about giving boosters as we see vaccine clinics shutting down, our vaccine clinics? I think the specific focus people were thinking about is at Harborview. If the vaccine clinic closes there, how are we going to get vaccines to our boosters to our special populations and our staff?
I don't know if someone from Harborview wants to answer that.
Sure.
I would make one general comment, though, is that with our vaccine clinics, we've kind of flexed in terms of what the need is going on at that time, right? In terms of if we see there's a push to vaccinate a large number, we'll expand, and then we may contract when there are periods of time when there are not that same need. Doesn't mean it's not available, but we have to be able to be flexible as we have throughout this pandemic. Sorry, John, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, just think about it, just like influenza vaccination. I think what we're increasingly sort of thinking about is how do we think about COVID vaccination like we think about influenza vaccination or other vaccines need to be repeated over time. And I think the employee health teams are working on how to make that part of our normal process.
Okay. So that way it's the time for boosters. We rev up and then it's a time that we're not doing boosters and we'll pivot down. Appreciate that. Tim, the other thing that people asked about relevant to kind of what John was saying before is we're seeing numbers go up in King County. And John said, we actually have high rates of infection right now. Are we thinking about changing any of our guidance across UW Medicine in terms of masking or physical distancing or any of those things right now based on those numbers?
Again, I'll make sure that John corrects me. I think this is something that we're continuing to monitor very closely, both within our infection prevention teams within UW Medicine, but across the university as well. Right now, we aren't making a change, but I think we have to continue to monitor the situation. And we've always said that we have to be prepared that we may have to at some time re-implement certain measures. But John, what are the discussions within MedTech right now?
I was doing the Q&A, so I missed the question. I'm sorry.
The question is whether we would go back in terms of some of our measures, particularly around masking, given some increase in the rate of transmission.
Yep. So just think about it like a toolbox. And we've talked about this the whole time. All of these pieces, respirators, masks, distancing, you know, are all parts, are all tools in the toolbox. And we may need to pull out some extra tools. You know, the construction is a little bit more concerning or more challenging, and we would use those things. We've learned a lot over the last 2 years, each of us individually, and how to incorporate those tools, how we incorporate into our work flows and so forth. And we would very, you know, quickly move to use any of them should we need to keep the environment safe.
I think it's the same message that we're hearing, kind of we'll pivot up and down as things change and become part of our culture. I also want to note that was the first time that somebody else summarized my question for me. So thank you, Tim. That was really affirming and I very much appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to shift gears entirely for a little bit. We'll come back to more questions about COVID. Because there was another thread that came through about something totally different. And Carrie, I'm going to start with you on this. There was a verdict in the last couple of weeks, I think it was maybe 2 weeks ago now, about a nurse in Tennessee who was convicted after having made a medication error where a patient died. And I think it's been very challenging to our community to see this happen. And what really people asked was, can our chief nursing officers comment on the impact of this verdict and kind of what that means for us? So I'll ask you to weigh into that for a second.
Yeah, and I would welcome Jay to weigh in here as well.
Yeah, Jay's up next.
I can say here at Northwest that this this verdict sort of reverberated through the community, and I had a lot of people reach out to me, distressed by it and concerned by it and asking, are we going to be doing anything differently? How does this impact us? And I guess what I would say is, first of all, I share that distress. I think for all of us in the nursing community, and I would offer healthcare community, this was a really distressing verdict. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that it went to trial, I think, was really distressing. I think we all support, you know, there are people out there who do bad things intentionally, and that's a whole nother bucket of, you know, that's entirely different, right? Somebody who intentionally harms a patient. I think in that space, though, of errors, all of us have made an error. And if you haven't, you probably just don't know it, right? I certainly made mistakes when I was at the bedside. I can think of two medication errors that I made. And I think we have all, despite doing our best, have made mistakes. And that's likely, you know, because of the systems issues at play. And so what I have reaffirmed in my messaging out to our teams, and UW Medicine did a really good job, is that we're committed to just culture. We are committed to really focusing on those systems issues that play into these errors. And it's not to say that in just culture, there isn't an accountability piece of it, because there is, but that, you know, our first commitment is to our teams, to fostering psychological safety, fostering transparency. And I think now more than ever, with everything that our teams have been through, we really want to reaffirm that approach and reaffirm our commitment to psychological safety and to supporting our teams and approaching errors from a very from a just culture approach. So Jay, I would welcome you. I think we all share that distress and so I've tried to message out to our teams as broadly as we can that message.
Yeah, I think you said that great, Carrie. I think it is something that has been brought forward here at Harborview as well. A lot of nurses and other ancillary staff are interested in it. Been trying to send out a lot of messaging for myself out to staff members, as well as talking to people when I'm making rounds throughout the units. I just pulled a team together to really put together some really good messaging in all of the ways that we message out. So we're looking at our Rising Tide, which is our newsletter here for nursing, to really like inform people of the structures that we have in place here that will allow a just culture, as well as keep our patients as well as our staff safe on the things that we do here. So really just using every platform that I can to discuss this at every level of staff in here.
I appreciate the messages from both of you, and I think it's really important. I also appreciated the message to the whole community. It feels so contrary to like to err as human and the part where we started to say it's okay to talk about these things because that's how we get better. And so I really appreciate both of you. And I'll just add, I think it has deeply impacted our nursing community, but it's impossible as any member of the healthcare team not to be sobered by these events. And so I think doctors are in a different place, but it sure felt like it to me like a sobering thing that feels unprecedented. I'll stay with the two of you and kind of stick with support. I had an interesting question that came in from somebody about how are we supporting our managers? And I think they were broad in the word manager, not just our nurse managers, but our managers across our healthcare teams. And Carrie, since you're unmuted, I'll ask you, like, what are you or we doing to support managers?
Yeah, I think this is a really important question. Our managers are, you know, super important, I think, in so many ways for our teams and leading our teams. And they have had a really tough role through this pandemic, like all of our staff have, right? And they're not exempt from that. And they've carried, I think, often what they do is they shoulder a lot of the burden of our staff, right? They're there to absorb that pain. And sometimes I think what's really hard is they can't fix it, right? I think they are used to being able to fix things and they have not been able to fix it. And so, you know, I think we're doing a lot of the same things that we're doing for our staff, right? There's the gut burnout sessions. There's things like Schwartz rounds. There's, I emailed Sherry and Marie and they gave me a bunch of different things, right? There's all the care for you. There's the peer support. There's those types of things. In addition, though, we are also coming to them and coming to their meetings and offering time to debrief, you know, talk about what their needs are, how doing check-ins, purposeful check-ins with them, whether that's, you know, with their leadership team or just them alone. And then I think lastly, you know, we're really looking at flexibility and how do we incorporate more flexibility into their schedule. So things like 9-9s or 4-10s, because time away is super important, as well as, like, you know, our managers get plagued with, not plagued, but part of what they do is also they support the team 24/7. And so, and that, you know, one manager said to me really poignantly, when I get called Saturday morning because we don't have staffing, the rest of the day, I am worried about my unit, which is absolutely true. And so I think, how do we create a structure that offloads them on the weekends so that they can have some time away and really get some rest and rejuvenation? So really important question. I think this is top of mind for all of us. I'm sure, Jay, you're doing some amazing things at Harborview, and I'm sure I've forgotten some things. So I'd love to hear that as well.
Yeah, I think flexibility is huge for the management group right now. They do carry a lot of the burden of their units 24 hours a day, even on the weekends, because they're so great at what they do. Their staff feels comfortable in reaching out to them and really asking them questions and engaging them when they need time to get away and try to gain some resiliency themselves. So one of the creative things we are trying to institute here at Harborview is where we're, you know, much like we have an AOC on call who takes all of the calls that are happening throughout the hospital, we're trying to do that for our management group as well. So when our managers are away, there could maybe just be one person that's a touch point for all the management concerns that may come through to really relieve those other guys of having to feel the need to be on call for their units. So that's one creative thing we're doing. Also, just listening. I try to take a lot of the burden off the managers. If I start hearing some of those things that are key words or phrases that they're using, I listen very well and just really try to take them to the side to take care of them. Because I know that they have gone through mighty trials through the pandemic as well.
I appreciate both of you. Kind of the care of the folks who are caring for others has been something that's been really important and hard through this pandemic. So I heard, you know, using the structural supports that we have, creating spaces for people to talk as well as listen to them, and then some structural stuff, increasing flexibility and ways to offload. I appreciate all of that, and I appreciate all the work that you're doing on that. So thank you for sharing and for doing that support of managers. I mean, I think also always looking for ideas and how to do more. I know that that's true for both of you. So if other people have ideas, we welcome them. Okay, I'm going to pivot to you, Santiago, and I'm going to have you kind of maybe wear your ID doctor hat for these questions to start with. One of the things that came up in actually multiple questions was how much protection is wearing a mask when everyone around you is no longer masked? So let me just start with that. Like, what do you think about that as we go about now? I'll just say when I go to the grocery store, most people are masked, but there are more places where there are fewer people masked. How much protection am I getting when I wear my mask?
You're less protected if the people around you are not masked, but you can still have a decent amount of protection, especially if you're wearing something like a KN95 with several layers that's fitting snugly. But yeah, you have less protection when people around you are not masked, but you can still be protected by wearing a mask of three or more layers that fits tightly and is comfortable and you wear all the time as part of your normal routine.
Okay, so less protective, but it's not futile to wear your mask.
It's not.
Still wear your mask because there's protection with it. The other thing that...
Can I add something? Yeah. Typically, the better the mask I wear, mm-hmm. the more the mask basically prevents me from getting other people sick.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But the mask itself is a membrane that's protecting me, and depending on the quality, it might protect others if I have COVID, right?
Okay.
So
the quality of it helps for me getting other people sick, like Anne was talking about, she was worrying about. But wearing a mask is protecting, a mask in general is protecting me from getting COVID. So thank
exactly.
you for that. The other thing that came up was this question of like, what counts as a close contact now if we're in this era of this more transmissible virus? How do we define close contact?
Yeah, so so the CDC hasn't really changed the definition. You still see that the close contact is having contact less than 6 feet of distance with another individual for at least 15 minutes in the course of 24 hours, 48 hours before the individual became symptomatic or tested positive. Now, that being said, that's when the window starts.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, we've learned so much about COVID and these new variants. It is a highly airborne virus. And therefore, I would say I don't put as much emphasis on the distance. I put more emphasis in being indoors and the prolonged time that I'm spending indoors.
Okay.
That's the key part for me.
So the formal definition hasn't changed, but you think, you know, makes sense to say, well, that 6 feet maybe isn't as protective as one might think, and that being indoors is really a risk, and then the time that you're indoors with folks.
It helps some, but it's not key, I think, because we've seen all the outbreaks of people like not being really together, like really close, and they still got the whole room, right?
Yeah.
Infected, exposed.
Yeah. I think people are just picking this up and worrying more, and I think a little more worry is appropriate. I'm in a little bit of a potpourri of questions phase, so excuse me for jumping around, but I had two questions about long COVID. And the first one is, can people present with long COVID weeks or even months after their infection, or is it usually something that happens just after you've been infected and you kind of stay not feeling well?
Yeah, so with COVID, we have two types of syndromes, right? We have the acute COVID that tends to last until, you know, it's been 4 weeks, so from the onset and 4 weeks. And then long COVID is anything beyond that that develops during COVID or after COVID. I would say in most cases, the symptoms are present and persist rather than having something new. However, some of the things that we're seeing in long COVID are things like arrhythmias or having more cardiovascular issues, or maybe something that's psychological or in the nervous system that may not be evident, and it might present a bit later.
Okay.
I do want to remind folks that we have an excellent post-COVID clinic at UW-Medicine that is outstanding. And also remember that we also need to, the diagnosis is really about excluding other alternative causes, because I might think it's COVID, but it might not be COVID, right? After 2 months or right. So it's important to rule those out and work with your doctor and potentially this clinic to try to get to the bottom of what is really going on.
Okay. So what I heard was usually it's right after or prolonged symptoms, but we do see some more distant. And if they're more distant, we want to have a higher threshold to say, are we sure it's not something else other than long COVID? I'm wondering if we could put the information about Jana Friedley's clinic or the resources towards what we have for long COVID in the chat, not you or somebody, because thanks, Sam, that'd be great. People ask about that. Okay, one last.
And one plug, if you really want to avoid long COVID, get vaccinated, get boosted, because that cuts your risk significantly, more than 50%.
Okay, so boosting helps decrease the risk of long COVID.
Yes.
One last thing about side effects of vaccines, actually, not long COVID, was I've had this question before, and it came up again, is this question about tinnitus or ringing in the ears with mRNA vaccines. Has there been more information about that?
Yeah, there's been a recent review where they found that the incidence is extremely low and extremely rare. I would say it's less than 1%. But it's there, and it's something that we've been hearing people have, and it's well documented. So it happens, but typically it's transient, and it gets better. And if it's not transient, I would have a visit with ENT, because sometimes a short steroid taper might help. Oh,
okay. So is a real thing, not super common, and usually gets better on its own. But if not, then see one of our ear, nose, and throat doctors or potentially have a course of steroids. Okay, that's super helpful. Thank you. Rick, I've left you silent for a really long time. I apologize. I'm wondering, there were some questions about kind of what's going on with our census and what's happening with borders. Where do we stand right now? And you can speak to Harborview. If you know about UWMC, that's great, but maybe to Harborview.
Sure. Well, thanks, Trish, and good afternoon, everyone. Sure. You know, I know census is running high everywhere. And, you know, I'll speak to Harborview just because it, I think, illustrates a lot going on in our community. And then what are some things we're really working on very specifically? You know, by way of numbers, we have really been seeing this high 400s today, 499. And we have this sense that this threshold of 500 is really sort of almost a tipping point to where we go higher. If we get higher and higher, we really see the entire organization, you know, truly pushed to its limits to be able to manage patients in the best geographic areas and with the staffing. You know, the four sort of 70s, we're pretty used to running our hospital at that level. And so the high 400s is, it's a stress, and it has really been that way now for a couple, 3 weeks. And so you really feel it when you're on rounds like today. Nursing teams, the medical teams all really sense, and there's that exhaustion that kind of accompanies such a sustained, you know, high census. You know, one area that I've learned about recently is that of dialysis. And I've learned that in the greater community, the dialysis needs are up about 40% than they were even a year ago. And that's a tremendous increase in the number of patients that need dialysis on a regular basis. And, you know, our dialysis services are really working to create the staffing. And here at Harborview, just over the last couple of years, I'm aware the number of monthly dialysis runs have gone from about 400 now to 600. And that's kind of a indicator of just that, you know, increased need and demand for inpatient care, for acute care services. And we, you know, asked ourselves, you know, what explains that? And I think the best that I can think of is that, you know, we know there's been delayed care over the couple years. Perhaps risk factors have increased because of some of that delayed care. Clearly, the discharge options are under stress, staffing in our skilled facilities. So all of that together is putting the census, which has been there throughout the pandemic, but now that we, you know, can focus on other things, we're really putting, again, a renewed focus on that very question. Just a couple things here at Harborview, and Jay is very involved with this, but we're organizing our medical leadership, nursing leadership, our care management teams, and taking what I'm really looking at as kind of a novel approach to the way we really ask the questions, what can we be doing to help patients move through? And just sort of picture this, that we're really going, in a sense, patient by patient. Well, how do you do that at the whole hospital level? Basically, you just take one service, one team at a time, and you go to that team, and you just talk about every case, mm-hmm. and you learn about who's really sick. Mm-hmm. You learn about who absolutely doesn't need to be here, and we can help with that. But you also learn about who's in that more transitional phase. What are some of the barriers? Is it deconditioning? Is it swallowing? Is it pain management? Those are maybe areas that we can work on medically to help, but it's also listening and supporting. and just knowing we are all in it together. And I think there's something energizing about that. At the same time, we also feel the sort of exhaustion that people feel. So, Trish, that's kind of an overview yeah. of how it feels to be working in such a high census situation.
I appreciate the nuances of that. And Rick, I appreciate the kind of, we're learning new reasons why we're still at this really high level that's really straining us, whether it's all these increased patients in dialysis or kind of walking through it patient by patient to say, where are there opportunities? What do we need to learn about kind of what this, where this stands right now? Jay, I don't know if you wanted to add something to that or not.
I don't have anything necessarily to add that Dr. Goss said, but it is very challenging and we do our thing every day to make our patients feel safe and at home. And it is a challenge, but we are surviving for the moment.
Yeah, I hear it. I don't want to minimize it because I think it is, you know, the fact that it's been day after day after day is what comes through in the questions. And I appreciate the efforts that both of you and all of the leadership team are doing to try to mitigate it. Thank you. John, I'm going to pivot to you for a couple quick ones before I hand off to Anne. So the first one is, any updates on vaccines for kids under 5?
So not a lot to report out. I know at the end of March, I believe Merck submitted, I wrote it down here, did submit they said they're going to plan to submit a application to the FDA for under 6-year-old kids. It's a lower dose, multiple doses for kids. They said they're going to do it in the next few weeks. I have not heard any updates since then.
Okay.
And I know the Pfizer trial is still ongoing.
Okay, Pfizer's still going, Merck maybe getting close to putting something in, so more to come in the future.
Yep.
Do you have guidance for folks who have kids in that age range? Because I think they're feeling like, should we stay in our bubble because our kids still can't be vaccinated, or should we voyage out? It's been a long time.
Yeah.
It's a really hard space.
You know, I don't really have good news for those families, and I'm sorry about that. It's, you know, I think someone recently gave me some, you know, I tend to, it feels like I get bad news a lot. When we look at those case rates right now, right, they're kind of going up pretty fast, pretty transmissible. We know the first surge of the Omicron put a lot of kids in the hospital, a lot more than any other time we've had in our time here. So what I would say is that, yes, these types of, you know, birthday parties, I think the QA and a pool party, if we can aim towards outdoors, right? Maybe even incorporating things like testing, antigen testing and similar into those. I think that there are ways to get our youth together in fairly safe ways. But it's not that we're not going to take the risk to zero if we get close together. But I, you know, it feels like we're sort of stuck back. We're actually moving backwards for these little ones. And I think that we just got to use those tools that we talked about. To the best effect, and I'll try to get them together as much as we can in a safe way.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I appreciate that it's a hard question. I think it's hard for those parents. And I think acknowledging that is part of it, but also these kind of be outdoors if possible, try to mitigate the risk, but acknowledge that there's risk for sure. I don't know that there's anything unique about this, but there was a question about masking requirements in clinical labs. Is it just surgical masks like we do in our other spaces in our clinical labs?
Yep. So it's just in our clinical labs, we want to be following the same thing. You know, think about the bedside person. Everywhere in those clinical footprints, that's where we want to continue to wear masking. And the reason we kept things in place was because we saw what was coming down the road with those transmission rates and just trying to keep our facilities, like Jay said, I loved how he put it, you know, sort of safe and, you said safe and homey, safe and comfortable. We want everyone to feel safe and comfortable at our hospitals and clinics.
I do kind of like the thought of safe and homey. That's an interesting.
I forget what he said, but it felt very positive.
Warm, it felt nurturing. I think that that's true. So thank you, Jay, for those words. Okay. I know there were a bunch of Ask an ID Doc questions, so I'm going to hand off to Anne. And I think today she's talking with Santiago. So Anne and Santiago.
Yeah. And first I'll say, I should have mentioned this earlier. It's out of all my close buddies, Trish wakes up the first each morning. And so for the whole time I was in Oxford, like I would always get a Trish text, like crazy early Seattle time, checking in on me and asking how I was doing. So thank you for that. It was really nice that you reached out. I really appreciated that. And appreciate you broadly. So BA2, not awesome. I got a be more conservative kick in the shins last week. So now I get to ask Santiago a couple questions around how are you feeling given kind of where we're at right now. So question that came in, a person who has a large memorial gathering to go to, it's at a restaurant, there'll be people eating and drinking. Would you go to a restaurant indoor gathering right now?
Oh, it's a tough one. It just depends, right? In terms of what is the risk benefit for me? How much do I think I want to be part of that? And if I really want to be part of that, I would probably be masked, and I would probably just try to like kind of be close to the door and kind of minimize my risk through the measures that John just described. I probably would not miss it, but I would. We are equipped. We have our gear. I would probably test before going. I actually been testing before traveling myself anywhere, or meeting with a couple of friends. Even I'll just test before the event.
How are you feeling right now about restaurants in general? Would you go out to eat these days?
I feel like we've only gone out indoors when we had no choice, and that tends to happen when we travel. So there's been literally three episodes where we ended up inside a restaurant, and didn't feel great. But in Seattle, we have options. So I haven't in Seattle, to be frank.
Question came in, would you have lunch with an unvaccinated friend?
I think it's doable. I happen to have no unvaccinated friends, to be completely fair. And we live in Seattle, so but I would say I think it's doable. I think you can do it outside. Definitely not inside, definitely. And again, it's just, I think I value friendships that have kind of the same principles and protecting the community and things like that. So I don't find myself in that situation as much.
Fair. A couple of questions that came in around travel. Would you go to a national conference right now?
I'm seeing a lot of people going to national conferences, and they seem to be having a good time, and it's really important for them. I typically just go to one national conference a year, and it happens to be later in the year, like close to November. And I haven't obviously gone, but again, I think it just has to do, as John many times has said, it's just the risk assessment of the situation. How much do you need this? And are you going to end up at a big like buffet with multiple people, all that? That wouldn't be my cup of tea, to be honest. It would be maybe grabbing a drink with someone, with one or two people that I really like and missed, et cetera, as opposed to the big party celebration. But again, I don't want to judge people, because I think that in the right setting, if I really wanted to do it, I would do it. I would just be more prepared and probably not unmasked throughout the time I'm at that place. No.
I know several of us have traveled abroad or have plans to. How are you feeling about travel abroad this summer? Would you plan for any?
I'm actually traveling abroad. I have a couple of trips. They're short. They're to see a few friends that I haven't seen in a long time. It's really important for me to do this. So I'm going to do it. It's basically 4 days in Switzerland. And there's five of us that we're going to be meeting. So I think I'm willing to take that risk. And again, I'm not concerned about the flight. I'm not concerned about my friends. We're all going to be testing. It really depends on what you do there. I don't think it's time to go to Disneyland, right, or Disney World right now. But it might be if it's outside and your kids really want it, right? So it's a question of, I'm sorry, I'm kind of wishy-washy on these things, because I really think that it has to do on how much you want this. And are you comfortable with the risk of potentially being stuck in Switzerland or the UK or whatever country, right? Because that's always a possibility. So I've been traveling with my laptop in my bag, just in case.
John hit on a couple of the questions we had about kids. So I think we're
probably Thank God.
Good on that front. So I'll spare you. I know how much you love me asking questions about kids. But there were a couple that came in around dating. Do you think folks can start dating again. And then the big question somebody asked was, would you date an unvaccinated person? So I think I can predict your answer there.
So dating, I think we have to continue to live our lives. I think there is a way to have a date outside, especially now the weather is getting really nice. I think it's really important to meet with other people. We're talking about one person. You want to be extra sure. You can test before you have the date. You can be outside. You get to know the person. You get to know. You become part of their bubble. I think it's, for me, it would be a green light if I really want to do it. I would go for it. And again, taking the precautions that I know to take. The dating an unvaccinated person, I would say that as an ID doc, it would be very strange for me to end up with someone who doesn't value vaccines, right? But, you know, we have family members who haven't been vaccinated, who fear vaccines, who have kind of bought into the propaganda around vaccines are bad and it's a political issue. So I don't know that I would be dating that person. But we have situations that I've encountered where you have unvaccinated folks in your environment, they're still your family, et cetera. So I think we need to gain some flexibility in that, but obviously understand that there's a higher risk from hanging out with that person.
Santiago, thank you very much for being on Hot Seat yet again. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
And thanks for always answering the dating questions. I'm pretty sure everybody else is very excited that you answer all
the dating
questions.
I'm married.
I know. And I just want to acknowledge that you always get those. So anyway, I want to thank everybody. Thank all the panel. There was a lot of disclosure today, which I think was intentional. I think it's a time when we're kind of all trying to talk about how we're navigating this. I will disclose a couple things as well. I did get a booster. I got it just the other day. I mix and matched. Like John and Tim, we're both like, we're in that age group. I'm in that age group where I should consider getting a booster too. And I did. And that's partly because I am standing with a background that is not my usual background because I'm at a national meeting right now. I'm in Tennessee. I'm in Nashville. For all you know, I'm wearing cowboy boots right now. I won't tell you one way or the other. But I came here to the Society of Hospital Medicine to run a course that I was supposed to run 2 years ago in 2019 and was canceled. It's a full day course on critical care for hospitalists. And I just want to say that this experience has made me exceedingly grateful. First of all, I heard a lot of stories, over 100 hospitalists in this room. It was great to teach in person. I wore a mask. But they were intensivists for the last 2 years in a way that they never anticipated being intensivists. And they did it with a ton less resources than we had at UW Medicine. So it made me so grateful for the community that we're in and how we got through the pandemic when I heard the stories of the folks who I was teaching critical care to, but they had a crash course in critical care for the last 2 years. The second thing is, it's super cool to be in another part of the country and there's hot chicken and cowboy boots and country music, and there's almost no masks here. And it is sobering and different to be in this space. And I just wanna say, I know we've been talking about how we're less masked in Seattle, it still feels palpably different. And I'm exceedingly grateful for the community that I live in and all the people around me that have really prioritized taking care of each other. So as we go into this next phase, and I don't know what it will be, and we've heard that there's some things that make us a little bit more concerned, I just want to say the same thing that I've said for a long time. You know, a big thank you to all the people on the screen, all of you who are out there in our community for continuing to take care of our patients and their families. But really what I felt so much is how we've taken care of each other. And so please keep doing that. Let's all keep taking care of each other. As Anne said, we're going to be on a kind of a monthly strategy unless things change, in which case we'll come back sooner. We'll see you back at Town Hall in about 3 to 4 weeks.